DW Inside Europe.
Hello, I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On today's programme, France's yellow vest crisis. At least 14 people have lost an eye after being shot by controversial police defence ball launchers, or LBDs.
I've seen several times LBD shots into crowds. And then you see people falling to the ground with leg injuries or sometimes eye injuries. There can be a lot of bleeding. It's quite shocking.
Also on the show, the number of anti-Semitic incidents across Britain is growing, according to a UK monitor.
Jewish communities across the UK will look at these latest figures with a great deal of nervousness.
That report makes for grim reading. We've got more coming up. And the security issue worrying European leaders. These stories and more coming up on Inside Europe. According to France's Libération newspaper, at least 14 people have lost an eye after being shot by police defence ball launchers since the country's Gilets Jaunes protest began in November. This new generation rubber bullet rifle, usually known by its French acronym LBD, has been banned in many countries, but France's highest administrative court, the Council of State, has rejected legal bills to suspend its use there. With this and the other latest developments in the French yellow vest crisis, John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
It has become the new staple of the news in France, the theme of the latest weekly act of the Gilets Jaunes drama. The most recent, the walking wounded.
They open fire on the people with a weapon of war. Is that today's France?
Jérôme Rodriguez, one of the leaders of the Yellow Vests, he already had a long black pirate beard. Now he has the black eye patch to match. He lost an eye the Saturday before, like 13 other Yellow Vest protesters, according to Libération, that has been trying to sift the true from the false in the claims and counterclaims over the casualties of this conflict. People injured when they heard this sound. The tally of serious injuries so far, 144 suffered by protesters and journalists. These include severed hands and fractures, organs having lost their main function, unquote, bits of grenade stuck in feet and arms, serious burns and cuts to the head. The enormous bruises you get from taking an LBD ball on the cheek are not counted, for example. Some of the worst injuries, and probably all the lost eyes, have been inflicted by the LBD, a dark grey, futuristic, sub-lethal weapon whose most famous version is the flashball, made by Vernet Caron, a firm that's been manufacturing hunting rifles since the 17th century. Rodriguez is exaggerating. It's not a weapon of war. You wouldn't want to fire rubber bullets in a war, but it's pretty nasty. Clément Lanneau is a photojournalist who's been following the protests on the ground.
Le LBD, oui, il est dangereux. On a vu beaucoup de blessés sur les manifestations des Gilets jaunes.
Yes, the LBD is dangerous. We've seen a lot of people injured during the Yellow Vest protests. The security forces aren't allowed to fire the LBD at the head or the lower body. But at demonstrations, people are moving all the time. There's a lot of movement, so it's difficult for them to aim properly. I've seen several times LBD shots into crowds. And then you see people falling to the ground with leg injuries or sometimes eye injuries. There can be a lot of bleeding. It's quite shocking. We're not used to seeing this sort of thing at demonstrations.
In Europe, LBDs have been banned in Austria, Ireland, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark and the UK. Only Greece, Poland and Spain, outside of Catalonia, allow their use. But comforted by the decision of the Conseil d'État, Interior Minister Christophe Castaner, speaking on RTL Radio, said the security forces absolutely need this weapon in their weekly clashes with the Gilets Jaunes.
There are rioters who come to demonstrations with the sole aim of fighting with the security forces. And I know that if we take these weapons away from the police, what will they have left when they are attacked and forced to defend themselves? They can fight with their bare hands, or they can use their service revolvers. Neither you nor I would want them to use their service revolvers, and I want to avoid hand-to-hand fights. What we can do is provide a better framework for the use of the LBD. I have ordered that whenever an LBD is fired, that shooting is filmed. Last Saturday, there were 32 LBD shots fired. 32 were filmed.
Oh, Although it is true that the level of violence at the end of demonstrations in France has become extreme in the past 3 years, not all LBD and gas grenade injuries were provoked by rioters. There have been numerous testimonies from people who say they were doing nothing violent whatsoever but were shot by the police. After talking to photojournalist Clément Lanneau, I spoke to a colleague of his, Laurent Bartoluzzi, who tells me he was shot in the leg with an LBD while reporting on a demonstration. He was wearing a red press armband, was a good distance from any demonstrator, and was shot for no reason at all, he says. Castaner's systematic filming of LBD shots could curb this sort of abuse. Another thing, says Clément Lanneau, would be to extend riot training to those now using this dangerous weapon.
The police all say there's not enough training, so this is something that can be improved on, in particular for the so-called anti-criminal brigades, the BAC, who have been drafted in to confront the demonstrators over the past few weeks. These men have, unlike the CRS riot police and the gendarmes, never been given riot control training. They're used to firing their LBDs in more static situations, against criminals. So maybe the solution would be, if we're not going to ban LBDs, to better train the people who use them.
The French Interior Ministry has ordered a further 1,280 LBDs for the next 4 years. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Many Europeans were nervous about US President Donald Trump's State of the Union speech this week after a year in which he imposed sanctions on imports of steel and aluminium, threatened to tax German cars, and revealed just how serious he is about pulling the US out of NATO. The speech ended up barely mentioning European interests, except for one, as Terry Schultz reports.
President Trump didn't quit NATO Tuesday night, which brought a sigh of relief in many quarters, but he did mention another security issue worrying European leaders who don't actually have a say in it, the U.S. withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF, after years of Russian violations of the 1987 bilateral accord.
While we followed the agreement and the rules to the letter, Russia repeatedly violated its terms. Been going on for many years. That is why I announced that the United States is officially withdrawing from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF Treaty. We really have no choice. Perhaps we can negotiate a different agreement, adding China and others. Or perhaps we can't, in which case we will outspend and out-innovate all others by far.
The pullout and the pledge to outspend and out-innovate the rest of the world on nuclear weapons got plenty of applause in the U.S. Congress. That enthusiasm is not universally shared in European capitals, which would be the battleground of any nuclear war between Washington and Moscow. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, still hopes the treaty can be saved over the mandatory 6-month waiting period. But more than that, ICAN's advocacy director Leo Hoffman-Axthelm says he hopes the seriousness of the situation leads more European governments to sign the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Most European states know exactly that nuclear weapons do not contribute to their security, especially since Europe would be the theater where the nuclear weapons would be exchanged between the US and Russia, so they would be squeezed in between. The European powers are all small to medium-sized powers that simply don't benefit of this arms race. So I think that in the medium term, it's going to become clear to everyone that this is a dangerous game.
The U.S. uses the same argument to try to garner European support for its withdrawal from the treaty due to its years of documented development by Russia of a missile system that breaches the allowed range. Now the U.S. plans to build its own new missile system, saying that will better protect European allies. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Arms Control Andrea Thompson briefed journalists the day after the State of the Union speech to hammer those points home.
This isn't a prototype. This isn't in a lab. This isn't in a warehouse somewhere. These are fielded battalions, multiple battalions across Russia that can range our partners and allies now. So the decision was made for us to withdraw from the INF Treaty, again, so we can build those systems that will defend Americans at home and abroad and work with our partners and allies. Now the Department of Defense will be able to conduct those research and development activities that they hadn't because we've been complying.
European governments say their own intelligence backs up American claims that Russia has developed a treaty-busting missile system, which Moscow continues to deny, but that doesn't mean everyone's comfortable with the direction this could be going. Even leaving aside the horrific prospect of nuclear conflict, the idea the U.S. may want to station more conventional weapons on European soil is unpopular in some countries, although those nearest the border with Russia share a different perspective and are more welcoming of a stronger American stance. Christian Mulling, deputy director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, explains that with the current standoff over Europe's head, there doesn't seem to be any way around more weapons being developed, if not deployed.
You can continue talks, and at the same time you have to develop alternative options if there is no way to go back to arms control. And we can't wait until the talks have failed, because the signals that we get from the Russian side on being willing to enter into meaningful discussion and meaningful potential arms control afterwards are not that positive. How can you force the other side to go into a more meaningful discussion about the weapons? And if this is not possible only through talks, then you have to put something else on the table that can be negotiated.
Mulling says NATO needs to come to terms with the threat and clarify its nuclear policy. NATO defense ministers meet next week here in Brussels, where this crisis is likely to dominate the agenda. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. A monitor in the UK has found the number of anti-Semitic incidents across Britain is growing. A new report from the Community Security Trust makes for grim reading. We've got more on that in less than 10 minutes. But first, the European Commission on Wednesday announced its decision to block a merger between two companies, one French, one German. They both produce long-distance trains. German giant Siemens and its French competitor Alstom produce the long-distance high-speed ICE and TGV trains, respectively. These are the very fast trains that speed along. Ryan Heath is political correspondent for Politico Europe. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, how are you doing, Keith?
Good, thank you. Now, this merger was very ambitious. What happened?
So the EU already last year had laid out in 395 pages a set of charges against the companies, saying that they weren't going to deliver the efficiencies that they were promising via the merger. And because they were such large companies, that they were really going to hinder the ability of other countries like Bombardier, a Canadian company, to compete in the market. And we already know that railways is not a very competitive market because it used to be very heavily state-arranged and state-owned. And so the EU is saying we're not going along with this just because France and Germany want to create what they call a national champion.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been following this story. I mean, it goes further. It goes like back more than 10 years.
Absolutely. So what Alstom and Siemens were trying to say is that they need to be big in order to compete against China. And what the EU is saying is that national governments and companies only ever come to it asking it to bend the rules when they claim there is some kind of crisis going on. And so you were seeing the Germans in this case making the very same arguments that the French made in 2008 and 2009 when they asked to be able to give special support to companies like Citroën and others in the car industry after the financial crisis. And essentially what the EU is saying is that we're the only people defending the level playing field in this single market. And even if times are tough, even if you face tough competition from outside, we're not going to break those rules and give up all of the distributed benefits of the single market just to help these one or two companies.
Uh-huh. Now, the Commission decision comes about 2 weeks after Germany and France signed a pact pledging deeper cooperation with each other. It's not off to a good start, is it?
No, but what is also going on is that the French and the Germans are doing much deeper defense cooperation, and we saw some new contracts signed in that regard this week. And that's interesting, because defense is an exception to all of these competition rules that the EU just applied against Alstom and Siemens. So if you want to join up on national security measures, then you have a much greater scope to do that than if you were just a mere train company or a car company, for example.
So is the plans to produce, because they want to produce a new joint fighter jet, is that going to get off the ground?
Well, all of these things do take decades, so it looks like they're on the right track for that, in the same way that France, Germany and other countries joined up to create Airbus more than 20 years ago now. So the proof is always in the results. You can't just say a contract is going to deliver a fighter jet. So we might be waiting more than 10 years to see whether that is really going to turn out. But if France and Germany do want to try and build up these national champions, they'd be well advised to try and look more into the defense military space to do it. They'll have an easier ride if they go down that route rather than if they try and do it with ordinary industrial companies.
Ryan Heath, political correspondent for Politico Europe. Thank you for your time and expertise on Inside Europe.
Thank you.
That report on anti-Semitism is coming up next.
The CTS recorded over 100 anti-Semitic incidents in every month of 2018. Jewish communities across the UK will look at these latest figures with a great deal of nervousness.
I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. A monitor in the UK has found the number of anti-Semitic incidents across Britain is growing. For the third year in a row, the Community Security Trust has recorded record instances of anti-Semitism, up 16% year on year. Jack Foster has more.
The highest total anti-Semitic incidents in the UK ever recorded in a single year. That's the headline finding from the Community Security Trust, or CST's, Anti-Semitic Incidents Report 2018. Last year, the CST, a charity created in 1994 to ensure the safety and security of the UK's Jewish community, recorded 1,652 anti-Semitic incidents in Britain. That's an increase of 16% from the previous year. The spectre of anti-Semitism has been growing in the UK over recent years, fuelled in large part by a scandal surrounding the opposition Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, whose vocal support for Palestinian communities in the Middle East has led many of his critics to accuse him of being soft on anti-Semitic sentiment inside his own party. Former Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks last year echoed what many in the country's Jewish community are feeling.
Anti-Semitism, or any hate, becomes dangerous when three things happen. First, when it moves from the fringes of politics to a mainstream party and its leadership. Second, when the party sees that its popularity with the general public is not harmed thereby. And three, when those who stand up and protest are vilified and abused for doing so. All three factors exist in Britain now. I never thought I would see this in my lifetime. That is why I cannot stay silent, for it is not only Jews who are at risk, so too is our humanity.
Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks speaking during a debate in the House of Lords in September. And if his words gave pause for thought, the findings of this week's anti-Semitism incident report make for even more unsettling reading. The CTS recorded over 100 anti-Semitic incidents in every month of 2018, the first time this has ever happened in a single calendar year. Almost three quarters of the incidents recorded took place in Greater London and Greater Manchester. The report also claims that due to a likelihood of underreporting, the number of anti-Semitic incidents which took place last year is likely to be, quote, significantly higher. I spoke with Dave Rich, who's head of policy and director of communications at the Community Security Trust. He's also the author of a book about those accusations of anti-Semitism levelled towards Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party called The Left's Jewish Problem. And I began by asking him about that claim that these figures may actually be a lot lower than reality.
The crime survey for England and Wales most recently estimated that only around half of all hate crimes come to the attention of the police. But there was another survey done by the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights last year, found that only 21% of British Jews who'd experienced an anti-Semitic incident or hate crime over the previous 5 years had reported it to anybody. So it's quite possible that the real figures are several times larger than the incident totals in our report.
Perhaps the most unnerving part of this report is a graph which shows a month-by-month count of the number of anti-Semitic incidents going back to 2007. Now, there are many peaks and troughs along that graph, but generally speaking, we can only see an upward trend starting around the tail end of 2014 and into 2015. Do you have a sense of what events might have precipitated that trend?
There's a whole series of events that have fed into it. There was a big war in Israel and Gaza in 2014 where we saw record numbers of anti-Semitic incidents in those months. Terrorist attacks targeting Jewish communities across Europe, but also targeting our societies as a whole. The divisive nature of the arguments over anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and also the rise in xenophobia following the Brexit debate in this country as well. And all of these different factors have fed into just a more general atmosphere of division and of anxiety in the Jewish community about anti-Semitism.
Dave Rich from the Community Security Trust. And the party political aspect Dave Rich talks about highlights a shift in the source of anti-Semitism in the UK, as seen by the CST's report this week. A prejudice which has traditionally been the preserve of the far right appears to have spread to elements of the left too. Right now, though, Jewish communities across the UK will look at these latest figures with a great deal of nervousness, particularly that consistent increase in anti-Semitic incidents for what is now the fourth consecutive year. Jack Foster, DW.
Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. You can listen again or download the podcast at dw.com/inside Europe. We're also on SoundCloud and iTunes.
This is Inside Europe. Every week we bring you the big stories from Europe from our team of reporters all over the continent, as well as in-studio guests. We deliver the latest in politics, culture and more. If you enjoy the show, do your friends a favour and tell them about us. We're here every week. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. Here's our email address, europe@dw.com. Thank you for listening. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. A very interesting 30 minutes coming up. Spain's far-right Vox Party puts gender equality and gender violence back at the centre of Spain's political debate. Exorcism in Italy, amid warnings from Pope Francis about the devil working to undermine the Catholic Church.
Every year, 500,000 Italians visit an exorcist. 500,000.
We got more on that coming up, and a German mother speaks to us about being told of her daughter's conversion to the ultra-conservative version of Islam, known as Salafism.
She got it into her head that she had to convert to Islam because it could protect her and protect her more thoroughly than the religion she grew up with.
Also coming up, parents are urged to restrict kids' use of smartphones, but that's easier said than done, as one mother finds out. These stories and more coming up.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
In the last four decades since the end of the Franco dictatorship, women's rights in Spain have seen huge advances. But the recent electoral success of the far-right Vox Party has appeared to unleash something of a backlash. Known for its opposition to immigration and Catalan separatism, the party is now putting gender equality and gender violence at the centre of Spain's political debate. Guy Hedgeco reports.
A demonstration by women in the southern city of Jerez. They opposed the arrival of a new right-wing Andalusian regional government. In particular, they were angry that the new administration needed the support of Vox. In exchange for its backing, Vox wanted the new government to strip funding from women's groups and for laws protecting women from violence to be revised. Such ideas have led many to see Vox as misogynist and extremist, labels the party itself rejects. Iván Espinosa, Vox's head of international relations, defends its controversial gender policies.
If a woman accuses a man of anything, the man is presumed guilty until proven innocent, which is absolutely radical. I don't think the answer is to criminalize 50% of Spain's population.
Espinosa says false accusations of violence by women against former partners are rife, and that the gender violence problem is exaggerated.
There is a number of women that are being murdered by men, which is always unacceptable. Even if it was just one, it would be unacceptable. But if you consider that more than half of those have to do with either tourists or immigrants who happen to be here for one or another reason, then it turns out that the stats looks more like half of those.
Last year, nearly 50 women were killed by their partners or ex-partners. But that annual figure has dropped dramatically in recent years, in great part because of cross-party cooperation. Conservatives and leftists have worked together on equality and gender violence. Marta González is a member of parliament for the Conservative Popular Party, which is leading the new Andalusian government.
Progress has been huge during the dictatorship. Spanish women could not, for instance, have a passport and leave the country without permission from their parents or husbands. They could not open a bank account without the permission of their husbands. And this has changed, completely changed, after the constitution of 1978. And in the last 20 years, we have made huge progress in what is related to gender violence.
Is there a possibility that all these advances that Spain have made over the years could be in danger because of the fact that your party is willing to make a deal with Vox, which is a party that opposes many of those kinds of advances, it seems?
Not at all. I would like to be very clear on this issue because we have to bear in mind that a very important agreement, a pact on gender violence and all kinds of violence against women has been very recently approved at the Congress and the Senate in Spain among all parties.
Vox wasn't part of that national pact, and although its demands on gender issues in Andalusia weren't accepted, its efforts to disrupt the consensus seem to be paying off. There seems to be an increasing willingness among certain politicians, commentators, and even members of the Catholic Church to speak out against what they call radical feminism and the so-called criminalisation of men. But the campaign for equal rights is not only being fought out on the streets or in the country's parliament. It's also being waged in places like this, a local government building in a working-class district of northern Madrid. Here, a weekly workshop takes place called Men Against Chauvinism. Fabian Luján, a sociologist, supervises the sessions, which explore how men can change their attitudes in order to improve their understanding of the opposite sex.
Hay una parte de los hombres que es contrario al cambio de las mujeres.
There are men who are opposed to any changes for women. With Vox's policies now seen as legitimate, that part of the male population feels in a stronger position to fight. A lot of men who were feeling unable to speak out because it was disapproved of now feel they have permission to take a very tough stance against the ideas and practices that women are putting forward. It's worrying because it's a step backwards.
Es preocupante porque es un retroceso.
For now, Vox's influence on the new Andalusian government is limited to areas other than gender. Instead, some of the party's policies on more marginal issues have been accepted, like protecting and promoting bullfighting and flamenco music. But this May, further local elections could see Vox's influence spread across the country. If so, gender politics will once again be at the centre of debate. Guy Hedgecoe, DW, Madrid.
From Bonn, Germany, you're listening to Inside Europe.
Throughout his papacy, Pope Francis has warned of the presence of the devil. Last September, the pontiff even said the devil was working overtime to undermine the Catholic Church. And it seems many Italians also believe in the devil's work. Every year, 500,000 Italians go to see an exorcist. The city of Rome has 7 exorcists. Our reporter, Angelo van Schaik, joined some of the faithful, hoping for an audience with Rome's most famous exorcist, Padre Vincenzo.
It's 7 o'clock in the morning, not far from the Vatican, and a church called Santa Maria in Traspontina opens its doors. People have been waiting outside for hours to be among the first to meet Padre Vincenzo. Padre Vincenzo is 81-year-old Vincenzo Tarabelli. He's been the official exorcist of the Diocese of Rome for 29 years. Padre Vincenzo is the most famous of Rome's 7 exorcists. And he and his colleagues are inundated with work. Every year, 500,000 Italians visit an exorcist. 500,000. So, is Italy a country inhabited by the possessed?
La richiesta è in crescita perché il demonio dice molto.
The demand is rising. People are becoming less religious, so the devil takes his chances. People tend to turn away from God and look for certainties elsewhere. But they think they'll find it with charlatans, and that's very dangerous.
People seek out Padre Vincenzo every time he's in the parish. They want to meet him, talk to him. But he only receives people twice a week, on Monday and Friday mornings after Mass. Padre Vincenzo hands out numbers to select people for his audience. only 25 people are chosen at a time. So bad luck if you're number 26. Then you have to get up early again next time.
People come here for an exorcism. Do you need an exorcism? I don't think so. Do not come here because of everyday discomfort. Your priest needs to refer you to me.
These two women have been waiting for Padre Vincenzo all morning.
I came to Padre Vincenzo so he'll bless my religious medals. He's stronger and more spiritual than other priests.
15 years ago, I went to Padre Amorth, the Vatican's most famous exorcist back then. I had a dream telling me to do this. My grandmother had just died, and I was looking for comfort, and I found it. Now, again, a dream has sent me to an exorcist. There are some problems in my family. My brother is very ill, so I'm looking for comfort again. If you're not feeling well and you're religious, you turn to God and you talk to God through a priest. But an exorcist is a more spiritual priest. So that's why I'm here.
Dimmi quando te ne vai. Vattene.
When will you leave? You've made her suffer a lot already. Go away, Satan. I exorcise you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
That's Father Cataldo, one of Padre Vincenzo's colleagues in Palermo, Sicily. And that's the way really tough cases are treated. The devil is exorcised through what are called liberation prayers. Sessions can be repeated if necessary. But Father Vincenzo says most cases are less dramatic.
Most people come here because of daily problems, trouble with their children, fights with their parents. Most of the time, people just seek comfort. I've seen thousands of people over the years, but very few people who are really possessed, maybe a couple of dozen. But I've met a lot of disturbed people, people who started to scream when I prayed for them or put my hand on their heads, people who are not possessed, but certainly disturbed. I'm convinced the devil exists, and his greatest strength is making people believe he doesn't exist.
Personally, I do not believe the devil exists, but I do believe that economic hardship and social problems can increase someone's need to hold on to something. So perhaps those 500,000 Italians who visit an exorcist each year are simply looking for support in these tough times. Angelo Waschaik, DW, Rome.
And I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. iPhone maker Apple has agreed to pay 10 years of back taxes to France. It's the latest US company to strike a deal with France, which has led a push through the European Union for higher taxes on technology giants. DW business correspondent Andreas Becker is here. Hello, Andreas.
Hi, Keith.
So how much are we talking about here?
Well, the exact figure has not been announced, but French media have reported a sum of 500 million euros for the past 10 years, which translates into about 570 million US dollars.
A lot of money.
Apple said in a statement what they always say in these kind of cases, that they know how important taxes are, that they pay taxes in all the countries where they operate, and that they follow the laws.
Now, France has been talking about introducing a tax targeting the big US technology companies known as the GAFA companies, Google, Apple, Facebook and Amazon, GAFA. Now, that was due to be in place from the start of this year. What's the latest with that?
Well, the bill will be put to Parliament this month. And once it's passed, the law will be retroactive to January. And it would affect companies with global sales of more than 750 million euros and 25 million euros in France. And France hopes to earn an additional 500 million this year.
Okay. And it's not just France, from what I understand.
No. I mean, the logical thing to do would be an EU-wide legislation. The problem is, All 27 members, if you don't count the Brits, have to agree on it. And some countries are strictly opposed. Ireland, for example, Luxembourg, but also Denmark and Sweden, they've attracted major investments from GAFA companies and they are afraid they might lose out. And Germany was not particularly helpful in pushing for an EU-wide digital tax. The Germans fear retaliation by the US government in form of higher tariffs on their cars. So the whole issue has been referred to the International Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and they hope to reach some agreement maybe sometime next year. In the meantime, some countries push ahead with a national tax. France, we just talked about it. But Spain, Austria and Italy, they also toy with the same idea.
Okay, so, I mean, countries like Ireland, their corporate tax rate is really, really low. So they attract a lot of huge US tech companies.
And they use the different tax tricks. Mainly they route their income through low-income nations, such as Ireland and Luxembourg, where the tax rate is much lower. And then they declare their profits there. But it was worse a few years back. In 2014, for example, according to the EU Commission, Apple paid an effective corporate tax rate in Ireland of, listen, 0.005% on profits, which translates into 50 euros for every million euros in profits. The practice has since been declared illegal and it has been changed. But one thing says it all, Ireland had to be forced to ask the money back. They didn't really want it. They much prefer their status of being Apple's darling because of their low taxes. And that brings also enough money for them and also jobs.
Yeah, exactly. Andreas Becker, DW business correspondent, thanks for coming on Inside Europe.
You're welcome.
Coming up in just a moment, a German mother speaks to us about being told of her daughter's conversion to the ultra-conservative version of Islam known as Salafism. I'm Keith Walker in Bonn, Germany. This is Inside Europe. There can be few things more terrifying for a mother than being told by authorities that your daughter is planning to move to a part of Syria under the control of Islamic State. One German woman, Monika Müller, found herself in that situation about 5 years ago. Although the information the police picked up in a mosque turned out to be a false rumour, Monika's daughter does have a history of Islamic radicalisation. She talked to DW reporter Matthias von Hein about her child's decision to wear a niqab and her determination to marry a man who shares her religious ideology. The names of people and places have been changed throughout this report. It's presented by Inika Mules.
Monika Müller is no stranger to the perils of radicalisation. A doctor by profession, she now also works with a project that tries to alert young people to what can happen if they go along with someone else's radical ideas rather than thinking for themselves. And that does not only apply to radical forms of Islam.
It would be the same with young people who became right-wing radicals, watching what happens to the family. How does it change a family? Radicalization can tear a family apart.
That could have been the story of Monika Müller and her daughter, Sophia. But things didn't turn out that way. These days, the mother stays in close contact with her daughter. They speak on the phone almost daily and visit each other when they can. But reaching that point was fraught with difficulty and long periods with no contact, sometimes for months at a time. Sophia, who is now 24, was a teenager when she converted to Islam. Her mother says the decision was triggered by a traumatic experience outside the family realm. She doesn't go into any more detail than that, but says it profoundly changed her daughter, who was only 12 at the time, creating in her a deep desire to feel protected. Sofia went to therapy, but when it failed to give her what she needed, she eventually made a decision that was impossible for her mother to understand.
She got it into her head that she had to convert to Islam because it could protect her and protect her more thoroughly than the religion she grew up with.
Sofia, who was born into a Catholic family and used to be an altar server, was 16 when she secretly started going to the mosque. Less secretly, she surrounded herself with girls who her mother describes as coming from Islamic or North African and very patriarchal backgrounds. The situation at home grew tense when Sofia decided to start wearing a headscarf. She was 17.
Sofia had noch.
Sofia has two siblings. There were always discussions, always arguments. She accused us of being infidels. She used to carry the Quran around with her wherever she went, or other books like The Muslim Wife, The Muslim Marriage.
Sofia eventually moved out and married a Turkish man her parents had never met. But the marriage didn't last long.
Her husband wasn't devout enough for her, so she came back to us. At first we thought it was over, that she had come to her senses. But that wasn't the case.
When Sofia turned to online Muslim marriage forums in her search for a more devout husband, the tension at home escalated. Her father confiscated her smartphone, she dropped out of high school just before graduation, and left home again.
A couple of weeks later, we learned that she had married a Muslim man and was now living in the city of Münster. At that time, she was wearing the niqab.
Sofia has since had two children and is now pregnant with a third. Monica regards her daughter's interpretation of how a woman should live as extremely regressive.
The woman stays at home and looks after the children and makes sure the man's dinner is on the table when he gets home.
Monica Müller tries to have a normal relationship with her son-in-law, who she describes as a fundamentalist. He has twice driven to Syria for an aid organisation called Medizin mit Herz, which the North Rhine-Westphalian Office for the Protection of the Constitution regards as an extremist Salafist operation, although she also says he has now distanced himself from the group. She knows of fundamentalist families that keep their children cut off from the world, not allowing them to sing or watch television, but she believes having kids of her own has softened Sofia's extreme religious views. Initially, she refused to send them to daycare, but now thinks it's important for them to grow up with other children. It's also a chance to make new friends.
Sofia doesn't have many friends because she doesn't come from around there. Most contact is through friends of her husband. They meet up with other families or within the family. My son-in-law has two brothers with children.
Sofia used to talk about moving to an Arab country, learning Arabic and studying the Quran, but Monica believes having children of her own has changed her daughter's thinking.
She's realized it's important to give her children a good education in this country and that it's not so easy in an Arab country, especially not for a woman.
Monica Müller no longer worries that the authorities will reappear on her doorstep to inform her that her daughter is about to move to Syria. But she believes the fact that the young family's apartment was searched last year while they were away indicates that her son-in-law is still being monitored by the state security services.
Inika Mules with that report, which was compiled by Matthias von Hein. You're listening to Inside Europe. amid warnings that too much screen time may be linked to psychological and behavioural issues, parents are urged to restrict kids' use of smartphones. Tamsin Walker reveals what happened when her daughter's school tried to tempt kids away from their digital devices with an archaic card game.
Liebe Eltern, usually when teachers send blanket mails to the parents of their charges, it's to tell them to buy a certain book, attend a meeting, or check for nits. I'm used to that kind of missive. But a couple of weeks back, I got one that cuts to the heart of a matter increasingly close to my own. It came flying into my inbox with the news that my kids' class of 12 and 13-year-olds demonstrates an unwavering and apparently unprecedented addiction to smartphones. And to flag up what it described as a miserable grade average. The connection between the two was every bit implicit, and the proposed solution was to teach the kids Skat, one of Germany's favourite national card games. Not so much as a means of heightening concentration, but of showing them that there's fun to be had outside the confines of their handheld devices. The collective parental response was part offended and part mocking, but on the whole, there was a sense of about time too. In truth, I couldn't quite see how a complex three-person card game dreamed up in the early 1800s would offer lasting alternative appeal, but I was perfectly willing to accept that might have something to do with the fact that I'm not much of a player. I was also happy to be proved wrong. Yet when the follow-up How We Got On With Project Skat mail arrived last week, it was to say that most kids have already lost interest. Oh well, worth a try, and I mean that, because given that 96% of 7th graders and even 60% of 4th graders in Germany have a smartphone at their disposal, and although this puts me at risk of sounding like I'm 100 years old, they're not generally using them to expand their young minds, grasping the need for moderation seems pretty important.
The teacher asked us, how much do you need your mobile phone from scales 1 to 10, and could you live without social media and WhatsApp and all that stuff? And most people just went right up to 10 because they wouldn't.
Because they wouldn't want to live without their phone?
No.
And where were you?
I was at 0.
At 0?
Yeah.
When the same bunch of kids were asked more recently if they'd like a general French-style middle school ban on smartphones, most were opposed. They can breathe easy, because that's not about to happen. Despite early reports from France that the ban there has reduced cyber harassment and is encouraging greater student interaction, Berlin's education senator has clearly stated that schools in the German capital should decide for themselves whether or not to regulate. And for now at least, my daughter's school has ruled it out. She'd have been happy with a ban. She really would. And I find her clarity on the issue refreshing.
I think I spend too much time looking at my phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you all agree. Think I should use it less?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm never far away from my own phone, and I regularly catch myself pulling it out of my pocket when I'm waiting for the traffic lights to turn green or for the bell to ring at school. But I've become more aware of it since the Skat experiment, and I'm now making a more conscious effort to leave my phone alone. Amazingly, the world has never changed much between my glances. So even if a class of 12 and 13-year-olds didn't get much out of an ancient card game, I'd like to think I did, without even having to play.
Tamsin Walker for Inside Europe. And that's it for today. The programme is produced with help from Helen Sini and Sarah Steffen. The sound technicians are Christoph Gruver and Leon Novak. And I'm Keith Walker. Thank you for listening. You can also subscribe to the podcast of the show on your favourite podcast provider, including SoundCloud, Spotify and iTunes. Inside Europe comes to you from Germany's international broadcaster, DW in Bonn.